Good morning and welcome to the April 5, 2021 meeting of the Public Utility District of Chelan County's normal meeting. We have a study and a business session today. Study session will be held this morning, business session this afternoon. Today, at the moment, we have three commissioners present. We're working on technology to get our fourth in attendance, and Commissioner McKenna will be joining us after lunch. I think our regular staff is in the room. I see Steve Wright, our manager, and Eric Walquist, our attorney, and I see a photo of Rebecca Garfine. But she's been talking to me, so I know she's in the room. We'd like to welcome everybody to this meeting and remind everybody that our meetings are recorded. And if you wish to address any item on the agenda, we ask that you state your name and address for the record if you're a visiting member of the public, and ask staff members, of course, to do the same to identify themselves for the recording. And if you are not on mute at this moment in time, I would recommend that everybody unless they're going to speak to an item, remain on mute with their this Microsoft Teams meeting. And we're all in a learning curve here, by the way. And so we're still asking a few questions, and hopefully we won't have a repeat of 2 weeks ago when Microsoft Teams decided to collapse on us in the middle of our meeting. That was really sort of a fun event that we really don't care to repeat. I believe that's all of the opening, and I'd like to at this time move to item one on our agenda, and that's the Pledge of Allegiance and Safety Minute, led by Pete Johnson, who I did hear earlier is on the phone. So will you lead us, Pete?
All right, good morning, thank you. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. All right. Well, as I said, my name is Pete Johnson. I'm a senior safety coordinator here at Chelan PUD. I also take part of the Chelan Douglas Utility Coordinating Council, in which promotion of 811. Since this is April is nationally recognized as Safe Dig Month. One of the questions that we get all the time is, what is 811? 811 is the national number designated by the Federal Communications Commission to help protect do-it-yourselfers, landscapers, and contractors from unintentionally hitting underground utility lines while working on digging projects, large and small. As we go through this, we want to look at the fact that this just isn't for contractors. Why would you call 811 if you were a private homeowner? In Washington State, every digging project requires a call to 811. Hitting an underground utility line while digging can harm the environment, cause serious personal injuries, disrupt service to the entire neighborhood, and potentially incur fines and repair costs to you. So when should you be calling 811? A lot of the projects that go on in our neighborhoods that go unseen is down to simple installing a mailbox, putting in a fence, planting trees or shrubbery, or maybe replacing a deck or patio. A lot of times we think of big excavations and deep digs that would require it, but actually any ground disturbance at all when you need to make that call to protect you and protect the utilities. So defenses and critical steps, how does 811 work? Well, it's one easy call to 811 at least 2 business days prior to digging. That starts the process of getting underground utility lines marked for free. That 48-hour time frame starts one day after the call. So if you were to call 811 today, if you had a home project going on, that means you would have to wait Tuesday, Wednesday, and then you could proceed digging on Thursday. When calling 811 from anywhere in the country, a representative from the appropriate local one call notification center will then contact all locators in the area to identify and mark the approximate location of lines within a few days of the call. So what happens if you don't call? When I'm sitting here reflecting these on our core HPI concepts, this would be under the drift. when we're out there installing, I actually had a neighbor do this where they were putting in a fence. They didn't think they needed to make the call, and they ended up hitting our power out there. So the best way to avoid damaging your utilities and risking injury or loss of the service is to get the call, get them out there, properly locate all underground utilities, and then commence with your project. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Pete? Good reminder, because we all, I think it was fairly recently in the paper that I read that somebody hit a line and caused problems, and all utilities have that same issue. So that's a good reminder for all of us. Any other questions or comments from commissioners? Commissioners, item 2 on our agenda is the approval of the agenda. And at this moment in time, if there's any members of the public present that would wish to speak to any item on the agenda, we would like to hear that request right now so we could potentially be aware that somebody wishes to speak.
Randy, this is Mike Cooney, and all I'm doing is just weighing in. I'm not on Zoom, I'm on the call number. So just wanted to, I'm here for a discussion or help or anything regarding affordable housing.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate knowing you're there. Anybody else? Okay, hearing no one else, commissioners, staff has made a recommendation that we could transfer agenda items 10 through 14 to the consent agenda. Is there any objection to that?
Randy, this is Ann.
Yes.
I have no objection, but I do want to, I just want to bring up the issue of sole source providers and ask the question why we still need to always include those on the agenda as a resolution for commissioners to approve. So we talked about that a couple of years ago, and I honestly don't remember exactly what we came up with. But early on, when I was a commissioner, we decided all sorts, single source items had to come before the commissioners, and I question that now. So I don't know, Eric, what do you think? When could we discuss that?
So I'm going to let Steve take it initially, Commissioner, but I think your timing is impeccable. We had planned to raise that issue today.
Yeah, it did. And okay, that's basically what I was.
I said single source. I meant sole source. Yeah.
So it's interesting you should raise that, because we just had this conversation last week, and we decided it was a good time to raise it with the board to talk about whether we should change that policy. And so we actually had some time scheduled today under manager items to bring that up.
Okay. Perfect. That works.
Okay.
I'm good then.
So that being said, any objection to any of 10 through 14 being placed on the consent agenda? Hearing none, we will consider them moved to the consent agenda. And the agenda will be approved as modified. Item 3, CPO winners, Steve Wright.
Yeah, this one is definitely a fun one for us. I want to spend a couple of minutes on this one. So we're bringing forward Glenn Ulrich and Scott Hansen as the winners for this month's cycle of personal ownership. These guys just did a fantastic job. We needed to do assembly work on B7 down at Rock Island Powerhouse 1. And they stepped up and took really full ownership of the planning of this work, working through, thinking about the engineering procedures, documentation that needed to be put in place, including there's quite a challenge to figuring out how to unwater units to allow the work to begin. They just embraced this in a way that was exciting for many of us to watch and see, to think through what problems they could solve before they became problems. So they were nominated for that work, for being really great at responsibility, empowerment, and accountability. subsequent to that, just because I was interested, I went down to visit them. And they had moved because there were some challenges with B10, getting B10 restarted. And I just have seldom seen so much enthusiasm in a group of folks in terms of doing the work. And they just engaged in a way that was, to me, I walked out just being a lot more excited about doing my job because I could see the excitement they had in theirs. And because of that, I couldn't think of a couple of folks who are more deserving than Glenn and Scott. So I want to take a moment and acknowledge them and turn it over to them and give them a chance to say something if they'd like to. Glenn, are you there? Glenn, Rebecca says she can see that you're there. We don't know if you're on mute. Scott, how about you? Are you there? Okay, we don't know for sure that they're there or not there. They had indicated last week they wanted to do this, so my guess is something came up that, again, these guys are so enthusiastic about their work that something came up and caused them to be pulled away for a few minutes. So we will maybe see if we can get them online and have them join us later today.
Okay, well, before we leave this subject, Steve, you know, and if they don't make it back on, I'd like to make a couple of comments, and then if my fellow commissioners wish to make any, they might. But when I hear a report like what you just shared about those two and the job that they are doing and recognizing that our utility has many, many moving parts, but our hydros are the heart and soul of this utility and what we do, and to hear about that type of enthusiasm within the organization, people taking the ownership, I get excited. That's really exciting to know that the excitement in the organization really goes throughout. So I'm thrilled that these two have gotten this award. So any other commissioner comments?
Can you hear us now?
There you go.
Oh, there you are. Yes.
Hey.
There you are.
Sorry. We were listening to you, but I finally just had to call back in. We're here.
Great. Okay. Well, it's that moment when we'd like to turn it over to you.
We just want to say thanks for the opportunity to shine and to do this work. You know, down here at Rock Island, a lot of it's been contracted, and we were given an opportunity to get back in and do what we do, and we just love the chance to do this work, and the ownership is there because we just absolutely love what we do, and you know, the adaptability. You know, we were given B7, and that was huge. We formulated plans. We got the unit unwatered on top of another unit that was already unwatered on the same system and went after it. And then B10 had an issue, and we were able to just drop 7 and pick up 10 and fix it. So anyway, we both just want to say thanks for giving us the opportunity to do this work.
Well, we as commissioners want to say thank you to you. This feeling goes most definitely both ways. We thank the inspiring approach you take to ownership and loving your job. It's great to hear that. Any other commissioners?
We're fortunate to have the crew that we have, and everybody just works together, and it makes everything better. And the higher you can keep morale, the better quality of work you get, the safer it gets performed. And that's just what we try and do.
We've had really good leadership, too. Our boss, Eddie Greer, and Tony Nelson support us 110% in tools that we need, manpower that we need. Our engineering team, Brett Bickford and Simon and Tid, they've just, I mean, if we ask for it, we get it, whether it's information or tools or whatnot. And unfortunately for me, I'm getting closer to retirement, and there's going to be a really big void, but I've really enjoyed my career here. I just can't think of anything else I would have rather done. And the people I've been doing it with to boot.
Glenn, Scott, this is Gary Arsenault, and I want to extend my personal thanks. I mean, you guys went above and beyond in this example, but this is just one example, and I know that you do this every day. You live by this. And not just you, but other crews down there, the folks that you mentioned. This is really truly what makes this a stellar organization is it's you. It's you guys, it's the crews down at Rock Island, the crews all throughout the district that have and embrace the attitude that you guys have displayed. So I just want to personally say thank you. It's because of you that the district is successful in everything it does every day. So thank you very much. And I heard that comment about retirement. I want you to rethink that. We'd like to, I'd love to keep you. But I'm also a strong supporter of retirement. I can't deny. Thank you for all that you've given
to the district.
I know.
Hard decision. Yeah.
But thank you so much.
Well, I tell you, what you have going on here at the PUD works. And I'm going to elaborate out a little bit. Our apprenticeship program, we're producing absolute top-notch mechanics. It's, I'm 32 years here, but some of the new journeymen that are turning out, their quality of work, their desire to do things right, it's just a whole new mindset, and you're definitely headed in the right direction with it.
Well, thank you for that information. Appreciate that. Good feedback.
Randy, if I may, please.
You bet.
Okay, so you can hear me. I'm using my earbuds with microphones for the first time, so we're checking some things out here. Gentlemen, I'd like to compliment you on the recognition for your work and your attitudes. I had a chance this weekend to share with a customer my excitement about being a commissioner, and the most exciting thing has been over the 15 years is the quality of employees that we have and their dedication to the organization and enthusiasm in which they approach their jobs. And this recognition epitomizes that. And so I was able to use it as an example. And it was so natural and so easy to do because of the enthusiasm that you share and the quality that you do. So I just want to say, not in front of you, but in front of the public, you are greatly appreciated. And Flint County PUD, for its customers, we do a great job, and I appreciate your efforts daily, and thank you.
Yep, you bet.
Any other comments? Well, thank you again. We really appreciate you.
You bet. Thanks, Gary.
Thank you.
Okay, back to agenda item four, the affordable housing discussion. Steve, do you want to start this off?
Yeah, I do want to just say, recall that I guess it was probably a couple of months ago now, we had the housing trusts come in, the three housing trusts from the county. And that set off a conversation around here around fees for hookups. And today we're going to come back to that conversation, give the board an update, give you some thoughts about how we might proceed with this in order to get some feedback. We're not looking for an action today from the board, but we're taking another step towards potentially taking an action. With that, John Stoll and Kathy Melton will be presenting.
Hello, Commissioners. John Stoll, Managing Director, Customer Utilities. I'm just going to turn it over to Kathy. Kathy leads our policy group and has done a lot of work to look into this issue and provide you some information as well as some potential options to consider, for you to consider as we move forward. So, Kathy, take it away.
Thanks, John. Good morning, Commissioners. Kathy Melton here. And Rebecca, can we go ahead and start on slide 2? Great. All right. So as Steve and John mentioned, you recently had a presentation that was given to you and an update from our local housing trust organizations, giving you an overview of their efforts for expanding home ownership opportunities for our low-income families in Chelan County. So, of course, that gave us a great opportunity to look back at the policy that we have put in place. And so that was something that was adopted after state law was changed in 1995. That gave PUDs the ability to waive those service connection fees for low-income home buyers purchasing homes from nonprofit organizations. It did have one minor little tune-up that was done to it in 1999, and that was adjusting those income limits. However, it became apparent to us very quickly of looking at that, that this policy just has not kept up with our local housing programs. And so, again, great opportunity for us to tune that up and make some updates. And as Steve mentioned, there's no action being sought today. This is just giving you our proposals. And as always, feedback is appreciated and welcomed. Can we go to the next slide, please? So this gives you an idea of where we're at today. So this is current conditions of our policy. And so state law limits the fee waiver to electric services. And as you can see, the district has those limits set at 200 amps or less for a single family residence. Again, this is a home that is purchased by low-income individuals from nonprofit organizations. We also have the income threshold set at 150% of federal poverty limit. Just to give you an example of what that looks like, for a family of four, that is an annual total income that is just under $40,000 a year. One other element of this is that the program at this time requires enrollment in our equal pay program, affords us the opportunity to waive those security deposits by enrolling in that program. And then, of course, those participants are subject to all of our other typical utility service regulations. I did want to note.
This is Anne. May I jump in here? Yeah.
Sure.
Can you just tell us a little, explain a little more about the equal pay program? I put a question mark beside that when I was reading through this.
Yeah. So the Equal Pay Program is a payment program that customers can enroll in that gives them the ability to make the exact same payment each month.
I got it. I understand.
Yeah.
Now I know what you're talking about. I thought this was different related to the low income. So I get it.
Oh.
Sorry to bother.
No, not at all. Great question. So looking back at the history of this, when this was adopted originally back in 1995, Scott Erickson, who, of course, we all dearly miss from being part of our organization, but they had projected out that approximately 6 homes at that time they thought on an annual basis would qualify for that. But according to our records, we've looked back, and it looks like we've only had about 1 home that has qualified based on the eligibility criteria that we have today. And so that equals out to about $1,700. For those service connection fees. Next slide, please. All right, so then looking at what some of our local programs have as far as their eligibility criteria, and then wanting to take into consideration of how we measure up with that, you can see that all have some varying income thresholds, as well as some credit requirements, such as minimum scores, that debt to income level, proof of income, and then programs such as Habitat for Humanity, they also require volunteer time to be donated in exchange for that program as well. Kind of that pay it forward concept. They have quite a bit of information that they have to send in, but you can see that they range anywhere from, and we also have Chelan Valley Trust that we looked at as well. And so the next slide is going to tell a better story as far as how that income eligibility measures up. Let's go ahead and go to that slide, please. You can see this is where we have that example of what of how we measure with our current conditions today of being 150% federal poverty level versus an average of what those other housing programs have out there in our community. And so we're seeing a range anywhere from 50% of area median income up to about 110% area median income. And so again, you can see the line that I have highlighted there of a family of four. Right now, that would be a maximum income eligibility for our program of just under $40,000. Whereas some of the others, even Chelan Valley Trust, they've got about 110% area median income. And for a family of four, that is still an annual income just shy of $77,000. We'll go to the next slide. So with that, we're going to start going over the summary of our opportunities for improvement that we found. So as mentioned, we're looking at this we're proposing to rely upon our local housing programs to perform the income verifications rather than having our own unique income eligibility criteria. Their programs are very well developed. Their candidates are well vetted. And as you can see from the previous slide of a family of four, our income range was significantly lower than what we're seeing as far as eligibility for those programs out there to qualify for home ownership. And so what we would do is recommend just we rely upon those agencies to perform the income verification. We would also remove the requirement for the Equal Pay program that we spoke about, because it really doesn't fit with today's needs with this program. Equal Pay is a program that is based upon historical usage of a customer. And so that would really be something that would be offered after the fact, after the customer has established that usage history, so that we can determine what is the best fit for their use so that when they're paying that monthly amount, they're not caught off guard at the end of the year with a significant overdue balance. And also, if a customer's credit history upon application indicates that a security deposit would be due, and if the customer is unable to pay that, our staff would refer those individuals over for assistance programs such as Community Action and to get aid with paying that deposit. And just as a reminder, deposits are held on an account. A residential security deposit is about $100. It's held on the account, and after a 12-month payment history is developed that is satisfactory, then that security deposit is applied to that customer's account. And one final element that we would recommend with this is when we're looking back and wanted to get a gauge of what our current policy says, we found that all of that information is still held within those originating resolutions. And so we would recommend pulling those policy requirements out of the resolution and placing those in our commonly used documents, such as our line extension policy and also fees and charges. Next slide, please. So in summary, this brings you to we're proposing what the policy could look like if you so chose. And so we would continue to have those service connections limited for single-family residences, services up to 200 amps or less, which is what we're seeing common with those sizes. Again, it would be homes that are being purchased by low-income home buyers from those 501c3 nonprofit organizations. Home buyers would qualify with all their income eligibility through those associated housing programs. And the fees that would be waived, again, would be targeted towards those service connection fees, which is the average estimated cost of the meter and transformer. And those would be specified in fees and charges. And not a change, but just a reminder, all those additional line extension costs and or applicable fees and charges and utility service regulations would continue to apply to those individuals.
This is Ann again. I have a question. So of these bullet points for the proposed policy, which ones are different? Would that be only bullet point number 4 and 5? Different from
it would
our
be four.
Policy.
Yes, you're right. It would be 4 and 5 ultimately. So it would just be removing our income threshold of 150% FPL and recognizing the income thresholds that our local housing organizations utilize for their program.
And
also
And
it would just be removing the requirement for the Equal Pay program, just simply because that's, I guess to put it, it's a little bit of putting the cart in front of the horse by offering
right.
the Equal Pay program, because it's really based on that historical usage.
Yeah, that makes sense. So the, let me see, where am I? The Associated Housing Program. So those were on a previous slide, right?
Yes. Rebecca, if you'll go back to slide 5, that will show Commissioner Congdon those amounts.
And they vary. So how would we average those? What would we do?
We would just look to the housing organization to inform us that these individuals qualify through their housing programs. So we would no longer collect the income information. We would get all of that from the housing organizations when they're informed.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. I get it now. Thanks.
Great. Okay. And so that's really all I had to share with today. Of course, additional feedback is always welcome. And if we've got comments and questions, we can add into that. But our next steps would include taking anything that we collect as far as feedback or direction today. And then our plan is to come back and visit with you again on the 19th with a resolution that would rescind those former resolutions. And then, as mentioned, insert our policy elements into the commonly used documents, like the line extension policy and fees and charges.
Kathy, I'm sorry if I missed it, but would you take a moment and just describe, I know you've done some outreach to the trusts with respect to how many houses we might expect to qualify under this program?
Oh, sure, of course. So I did. I had great conversations this morning. I spoke with Kaylin up at Upper Valley Mend, and at this time they're looking at building 3 homes by next summer for low-income families up there that would qualify for this. Also had a great conversation with Tom Nee, and he said that as the Wenatchee program is really, as he called it, anecdotal at this time. They're right in the beginning phase of developing their strategic plan. But at this time, they have it planned on launching an initial project in 2022, and that would be with essentially 5 units or 5 homes. And then beyond that, they're hoping to double that each year. So at the end of 5 years, they're looking at hoping about 40 homes or units would be available at that time. And I also had a great discussion with Rachel up at Chelan Valley Housing Trust. And they just wrapped up 5 units, and they are looking over the next 5 years about the same as Wenatchee. They're looking at anywhere from 30 to 40 units. And that, I believe, is a project that they're referring to as the Anderson Project. And that's some 9 acres that they've recently acquired.
And so that would be 30 or 40 units over the 5 years, or 30 to 40 units per year?
Over the 5 years, yes. Thank you for that clarification.
Okay. So, Commissioners,
if we have any questions for Kathy, I know that Mike Cooney's on the line and would... I'm assuming like to speak to this issue, but if we have any questions for Kathy.
Commissioner, if I could, I'd just like to jump in for 1 minute and offer one more quick thought. So as staff, we did focus on the question that Commissioner Congdon asked, which is what's the right approach in terms of qualification for the program? And we kind of have 2 paths we can choose here. One path is one where we set the income level, and then the trust would have to comply with what we came up with. The other path is one where we just allow them to set the income level, and as a 501c3, hopefully they're making good judgments with respect to what should qualify and what shouldn't for their community, and we would just take their judgment on it. The first path certainly gives us more control, more comfort, because we're confident exactly what qualifies. But candidly, it's administratively burdensome, because we would have to actually, first of all, define the income level that qualifies, but then we'll have to manage to it as well. And the second path is just a lot less administratively burdensome. So then we looked at, well, roughly how many houses are going to qualify and how much money are we talking about here? And we think that based on the numbers that Kathy came up with, that, you know, even in an expanded program, we're talking about $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year. And candidly, we could spend a lot of time, staff time, that would add up to numbers that would be in that range just to try to manage a program like this. And so that's why you're seeing a recommendation that proposes to just adopt what the trust come up with as their definition of what qualifies. And when they say it qualifies, then that's good enough for us. But this is something that you should ponder, because I think it is there's not a clear answer to that. That's just our recommendation.
Mr. Congdon.
Yeah, you saw me put my finger up.
Thank you. Darn right.
I really want to give this more thought, but I don't know. I just kind of hate to give. It's not a control issue. It's just that, I think this is something that we should control and determine in-house. I mean, I just hate to leave it completely open-ended. Well, it's not open-ended, but leave it up to the different housing organizations to set the threshold on this. I'm not comfortable with that. I'm not saying I agree with the program. I think it's critical. It's very important, but I don't want to have our complete control and determination of who qualifies taken away from us. I'm not comfortable with that.
Commissioner Arsenault.
Thank you, Commissioner Smith. I am in big support of the program. Let me start there. I think it's a worthy program and necessary, and homeownership leads to so many benefits for the community as a whole. Where I am having a little angst is in the open-end nature of the benefit, in so much that although we have data looking backwards, I think we're in unusual times where things are not what they used to be with respect to housing and just a host of things. And so I would be comfortable or more comfortable, I would say, if we had some kind of bookends on this that would limit the unintended exposure and the nature of an unknown going forward. So perhaps I might suggest that we have a sunset clause at some point in the future with a review option, so that future boards would be in a position where this doesn't fade into oblivion and get forgotten like it has already. And I referenced the 1994 resolution, that it has to come back to the surface at some point, and the future board gets to look at it and look at the success of the program and extend it. The second suggestion that I might make is that possibly there would be a dollar amount cap in any one given year, so that what is well intended today and seems to be of minor financial impact to the district doesn't surprise us in the future with an explosion of this type of request that could take us quite by surprise at some point. So I'm not proposing a dollar amount that bookend would be, but just recommending that there be some kind of an annual limit so that the district isn't caught by surprise on this well-intended and I think well-deserved program that we're trying to implement.
Commissioner, this is Eric. If I may, I think the statute does allow discretion for the board to choose between the alternatives that staff has described for you as Steve relayed them. I do not think the statute would give us the flexibility given the non-discrimination provisions to say that the first 10 through the door would get it, but the 11th and thereon would not, which challenges your annual spending cap. There are many programs out there, as you all know, that define low income differently depending upon the purpose of the statute. The one thing that is consistent, however, that is that for purposes of those programs, and this is also included in the statutory provision here, is that once we make the decision to do it, then we need to do it for everyone that would be eligible under the parameters that we've established. We could revisit those thresholds periodically, as you've suggested, but I do think we would be challenged to implement a hard cap in an annual spending threshold.
Commissioner Bowles,
go ahead.
Yeah. Gary, did you want to finish? Did you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Dennis. I just wanted to ask Eric on that same note, Eric. If I'm hearing you correctly, then there's no way to limit the potential exposure, financial exposure, other than to have the ability to do a sunset. Is that right?
Well, I think that's one way you could do it, Commissioner. I do think that you could control it based upon best available information going forward through things like the eligibility criteria, revisiting periodically the program to determine impacts. But effectively, I'm going to say yes, we would be challenged with setting a spending threshold up front.
But Eric, let me just check and see. I think we could have, the resolution could direct the staff that if the costs are going to exceed a certain
Absolutely.
Amount, that it would be brought back to the board, which would then give the board the choice as to whether to amend the resolution in some fashion. I think we could get to the same outcome by some tracking mechanism that at a level that the board felt comfortable with.
Yeah, I agree, Steve. I'm certain that there are probably a number of ways we can do that, yours included.
Dennis,
thank you.
Yeah, my question, first question is for Steve. Steve, if you will share with me, with us, what thought has been given to what budget category these dollars would come from?
Yeah, we did give some thought to that, and we're thinking about whether this should be a PPB program or not. And our conclusion was that because this is authorized by law and it's an option available to the board, and it's one, in fact, the board has previously included as part of the mission of the organization, that we would not propose this to be a public power benefit program, and it would just be a standard part of the business operation of the utility. I'll be honest, it's a bit of a close call. Could potentially go the other way, and if the board thought differently about that, wouldn't object. But we felt comfortable because of the statutory authorization that this would not be a PPB program.
Okay. I appreciate that. Second is more of a comment than a question. I had the privilege at one point to be on the founding board for Habitat for Humanity for Lincoln County. And one of the most impressive pieces of being on that initial board was looking at the structure for vetting applicants. And I really applaud the staff and leadership in saying, let's not replicate that. Let those organizations do it. And so I have essentially very few reservations about, or any almost reservations about those organizations identifying appropriate recipients of this assistance from Schlein County PUD. And I think to be honest, it's another way of gaining another customer, enhancing the quality of life in Schlein County. And when I look at the income thresholds, the need here is significant. And the organizations that do this type of work work extremely hard to in their own efforts to support the community and those who are oftentimes the least among us. And it's with real appreciation that I am supportive of this process. I think it's solid. I like the looks of it. But I also agree, I would prefer for it not to come out of a PPB.
Thank you. I realize Mike Cooney is on the line, and I imagine that he might like to say a few words. Is that correct, Mike?
Well, yeah, and I wish we weren't on Zoom. I'd come down and hug you all. But I'll just weigh in and keep it short and simple. I listened intently, and I get all of it as far as the discussion, as far as capping and the income qualifying. I think it was maybe it was Dennis that made the last comment. Each community land trust has a pretty rigorous standard to get qualified. We are, if you think of it as a thermometer, the Wenatchee Housing Authority, using federal funds, will help people get into affordable rentals or affordable homes, and they take you from like 0 to 40% AMI. We pick it up where they leave off, and we're servicing about 50% of our Chelan residents or Chelan Valley residents make between $35,000 and $65,000. So the qualifying to get one of our homes is tough. And this is one point that I'd really like to underline and have it. The city has reduced the hookup fees or waived the hookup fees when we went through a thing, and it wasn't anything except that they could legally do it for two groups, affordable or attainable homes, which is the middle of your demographics. It's also for senior living. Well, how did they feel comfortable with the thing that they could only do it for is if it's deed restricted or resale restricted, which we have a resale formula of it can appreciate by 1.5% per year. So there's nobody going to come in and make the investment and reap a lot out of it. So that is a really big thing. I would hope we would do it either way. We could help the three local community land trusts could help put together the criteria. I think there needs to be criteria of you have to make so much to get into one of the homes, or there are other people servicing them. And then you can't make so much. And that deed restricted, resale restricted, there's no flipping of the homes. There's no short-term rentals of the homes. And I just wanted to clarify one thing. We are having an open house on April 17th for our first five homes. We're having a ribbon cutting, not an open house. And the five families worked hard to get into these homes. We had about 20-some people for each home wanting these homes, but the criteria, as I said, was getting harder. And one clarification is out on Anderson Road, which we're it's going to be called Bailey Park after It's a Wonderful Life, and that'll be five homes per year. We're building up to 45 homes on that 9 acres. So that's some input from this end.
Thank you.
Yeah, if I if I may add one thing, in speaking with one of my family members yesterday, he and his wife are considering building a new home. And the quotes they're receiving from contractors in the area are in the neighborhood of $300 a square foot. I mean, that's where housing costs have gone. And when you look at a 2,000 square foot home for a family of need, that's a $600,000 house if you're using a contractor. And to be able to genuinely assist people in acquiring a house, this is a really serious discussion and a very important one. Thank you.
I'll just add, I returned last night from Bend, Oregon, and visited with their housing advocates. It's actually part of their city economic development department. And Bend, like Jackson Hole and Sun Valley and all of that, is really Chelan Valley 20 years from now. So anything, any place that's beautiful and destination, the people that make up the fabric of our town are having a harder time getting their first home in Chelan.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Any other comments on this? So, Steve, where does this lead us?
Well, I think we've got some work to do. I've heard a little bit of different comments from commissioners and trying to think through the question of whether we place limits or not. I also heard Mike Cooney suggest that the Housing Trust might be able to give us some ideas about how to think about that. So I would suggest we have some, we've heard a lot from the commissioners. Most important thing is we heard support to continue to move forward, not to stop and rethink whether we should be doing this at all or not. But the how we do it still has some questions associated with it. I think the one thing that probably is easy to say we should do is some sort of a sunset review provision so that no matter what we come up with, because we're not going to be able to get this exactly right the first time. So we know we need to do something on that. And with that, I'd ask that we get some opportunity to be able to work with the commissioners between now and a future discussion at a board meeting.
Ann?
Thanks, Randy. So what's in the back of my mind is what we all look to when we do anything, and that's the best for the most for the longest. So with that and with everything I've heard, that the one thing that really nags at me is the wildly differing thresholds from the different housing organizations throughout the county. And I just you know, I'm just really, really uncomfortable leaving that part up to the different. I mean, this will be our program, and we're happy to do it, and it's very important. But I think we need to determine our own destiny on this, and I'm concerned about what Gary mentioned as well about a sunset on this, where this could possibly go. There's so many uncertainties, so many unknowns. So I just don't like giving up our ability to control any part of this.
Last comments. I think Steve recognizes, or management recognizes, that we've got to put their thinking cap on a little bit and do some additional work on this.
I'll just throw out, I understand any fears that anybody has on keeping it open-ended. We would not want you to be in that position. What I'll promise to do is we'll come up with a threshold for the income levels. We'll come up with some thoughts, and I will forward that on to Rebecca and share that with the commissioners. And I just want to finish with thanks for even having this discussion. We cannot do it alone. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Mike, if I could just make a request, when you do that, if you could collaborate with the other land trust, so it would be a joint recommendation from the three, that would certainly make it easier for us.
Absolutely. As soon as I hang up, that's what I'm doing.
Okay. Any other discussion on that before we move on?
Just to thank you. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Have a great meeting.
Okay, resource adequacy.
Great. So Rob Davis has come on the line. I can actually see him, which is terrific. So Rob is going to give us an update on resource adequacy. You're going to focus particularly on the governance component of this, and then would expect that at a future meeting we'll come back and talk about the standards substantively, how they would work and how they would apply to Chelan PUD. Take it away, Rob.
Thank you. Good morning, Commissioners. Rob Davis, Interim Managing Director of Energy Resources. We hit a good milestone in the Northwest Power Pools program, some governance direction from the executive, so it made sense to come and talk to you about that today. And like Steve mentioned, the future updates, a lot of work going on, a lot of work groups, a lot of involvement even by Chelan PUD staff. And so we will continue to keep you updated as we get to good check-in points. This is a really big deal for our utility, but also for the region. It's not just about trying to capture the full value of our resources, but resource adequacy, we've known from planning studies for the past few years, is important to regional reliability. And we've had real instances in the past couple of years that have hammered that home. So it's something that we're spending a lot of time focusing on. We want to make sure that we get it right as part of the interconnected grid out here, and ideally avoid any unintended consequences of a bad reliability event, loss of load, or even a near miss. So that's why we're spending some time on it in the regional group and spending some time talking to you about it today. It's a fairly high-level overview, so if you have detailed questions, by all means, shoot them at me. I'll answer them to the best of my ability. At the same time, if I start geeking out a little too much on some of these details, feel free to tell me to go faster or funnier and prod me along. I cut my teeth on similar stuff when I joined the industry a few years ago, so really exciting stuff to work with, at least on my end. We want to move ahead to our agenda. Just a quick look about what we'll talk about. Again, a high-level overview of the program itself, just a refresher on some of the elements involved and what we're trying to achieve. A quick look at timeline, which is important for the governance discussion we're going to have, and then into the meat of it, which is the update on the direction we've got on how to shape governance for this program, and then we'll close out talking about next steps. So the program itself has two main components. There will be a forward showing program and an operational program. So the forward showing is looking ahead to the peak seasons, both winter and summer, to make sure that all the participants have sufficient resources to meet their forecasted load, including a planning reserve margin. So these are the winter season is November through March. The summer is June through September. And 7 months in advance of both of those, the utility will have to show that it has sufficient resources, either owned or contracted for, or to meet what its expected load is going to be. There's a little bit of a cure period there if a utility comes up short. But following that, there are expected to be financial penalties designed to encourage people to provide for their own loads. It's a lot of work going underway, collecting data, doing modeling and testing to make sure it works. And we've even run a couple of interim programs, one summer and one winter, to get a feel for how the information sharing and planning will work. The operational program is closer to real time, so that when a utility has met its forward showing requirement, but then operationally is going to be short of its loads, its forecasted loads, that it has the opportunity to tap into pooled surplus resources. The idea being that across the power pool footprint and the even broader resource adequacy footprint, we've had a number of folks express interest in joining that are outside the normal Northwest Power Pool region. Those resources and loads will capture some diversity by that big footprint, and that surplus can be shared if somebody is legitimately short and has an operational need, that they could be matched up, terms could be worked out, but that we could avoid an event simply because there wasn't good good coordination across the area. And then finally, today's focus, we'll be talking about governance, and this is how we run the program, who's in control, who administers the various pieces of it, how they operate, and what sort of oversight the participants would have in the program. Next slide, please. There we go. Our timeline, kind of a busy chart there, but the important things to note here, first, there's been a lot of work ongoing. We're already coming up to the end of our second phase. We'll be finalizing the design work, the detailed design work this summer, so that we can go in and start an implementation phase that would be not binding, but really kind of a good test run to make sure that all the pieces we've put in place will actually work the way we intend them to. And that will lead us into having a binding program where we can actually hold people accountable, but at the same time, if everything works as designed, that we'll be able to take advantage of those benefits and make sure that we're able to serve load across the region in various situations. Two arrows there at the bottom, green and red. The red is to show you where we are today, like I mentioned, finishing our detailed design. The green is where we expect to have all our governance in place and approved. So that would be our first binding showing, which would be March of 2023, for the upcoming winter season in 2023. And the importance of that date is that we have to have any FERC approvals done. We have to have the organization stood up and ready to run. Everything has to be in place then. For FERC approvals, it takes, conservatively estimating, about a year. Once you submit it to them, that gives you time for them to review. If they have any issues that need addressing, to send it back, and then for the organization or the participants to revise and resubmit for final approval. So if we walk back a year from that, that's when all the documentation has to be complete, which would be about March of 2022. And that's a little less than a year from now, which means we've got about a year to get all the program pieces complete, written up, and submitted to FERC for their approval, or to start the process for their approval. And the reason we are doing that, especially speaking with you today, the question of FERC involvement and FERC approval is not normally something that we deal with here in public power. Early on, we got the advice, we being the PowerPool participants, got the advice of expert counsel there in D.C. that deal with FERC on a regular basis to advise on what FERC's role might be in this program. The PowerPool program is actually unique. Most resource adequacy programs are part of an organized market or an ISO or an RTO. Those entities, in some cases, even have capacity markets in place. So building a standalone program, there wasn't a lot of guidance about whether FERC would be involved and to what extent. But based on that research, we expect that the program would be subject to FERC's jurisdiction, meaning we'd need their approval of the program elements. We'd have to submit a tariff that governed how the program operated, and that in addition, the way that the program is going to run, with resource decisions being made, with penalties being assigned and penalty revenues being reallocated to other participants, that FERC will require the entity that runs this program to be independent. It's established independence requirements for its organized markets, and those would likely apply to this program as well. So whoever is in charge of this program would have to be financially independent from each of the participating utilities. Now, this isn't set in stone. Like I said, we don't have good, solid direction on this. But there's a preference among the participating utilities to work with these assumptions because there's a pretty good timeline risk that if we operated outside of this and designed our own set of governance rules and took it to FERC, that they could reject it and really set the program back. And beyond just the timing and the need to get this up and running for reliability reasons. We also would risk, you know, either losing participants along the way if there's too much shift in the timeline, or getting rules put upon us that we may not want. Resource adequacy is getting a lot of attention from the states. It's even getting some attention at the federal level. And so the ability to control our own destiny really depends on us having a program that is well-designed and meets any requirements that the FERC may choose to impose. Again, this is a shift in the public power position. You may recall back during the MC initiative when we were looking at imbalance market alternatives here in the Northwest, that there was really a lot of time and effort spent on how to address the idea of FERC jurisdiction over that program. It's been a lot smoother process, I will say. A lot more of the public power participants are willing to accept these conclusions, primarily because of the importance of the program and also because of its limited initial scope. We really are just focusing on a program that sets standards to make sure people have adequate capacity for load service, that we provide an opportunity for some pooling of benefits, but it really is limited just to resource adequacy, and so that limits the amount of reach into other programs that FERC may have.
Rob, if I may interrupt for a second.
Certainly.
Bullet point number one, could you share with me, please, how the word tariff is being defined here?
So tariff is a pretty general term. Under Section 205 of the Federal Power Act, the public utilities being not public power utilities, are required to file their rate documents in terms and conditions with FERC. So here, tariff just generally means the resource adequacy program documents that would have rate-related terms and conditions in them.
Okay, thank you.
Good question, thanks. So working with these assumptions, we developed a few options. There was a working group I participated on. We had a few folks from public power, a few folks from industrial or investor-owned utilities, and worked through a set of options. And the takeaway from this graphic is that there at the top, option A, is the most independent. So a governing entity that is fully independent from all the participants has the best likelihood of getting approved at FERC, all the way down to option delta there, which is the most control you could have from the participating utilities, but then the least likelihood of being approved at FERC. And so just a decreasing scale of likelihood of approval, but an increasing scale of local control over the program. So with these elements and fleshed out in a lot more detail when we took it to the utilities, took a survey, anonymous survey, to get feedback on the direction that the group wanted to go. And we found overwhelming support for an independent governance option. And again, this was driven by concerns of timeline risk and also the consideration that, you know, this is a limited program and FERC jurisdiction isn't as scary as it might otherwise be. But along with that, there was a lot of feedback from survey participants that they still wanted strong decision-making authority for the participants in this program, so some degree of local control. And so, of course, that creates a tension, also a tension with the idea that if we have a stakeholder committee that's participating, FERC guidance generally has been that stakeholder committees really are stakeholders. It's not just the program participants, but it's other concerned entities in the footprint. So this could be consumer advocate groups or environmental groups, perhaps state regulators. So it's a pretty broad pool. So you do have that tension as well. So as we were looking at how to address all these conflicting priorities, we got a very favorable order out of FERC related to a Southwest Power Pool proposal. So if you could jump to the next slide. This Southwest Power Pool had proposed expanding or actually standing up another imbalance service market, but this time in the Western Interconnection. So they had been working for a while with utilities in the Rocky Mountain region to set up an energy imbalance service. And as part of that, they had developed a governance model that was very favorable to participant control over decision making. So it sets up the Western Markets Executive Committee, which is essentially a members committee that has significant control over the program. This was in line with the option B, the option Bravo that the power pool was looking at. It even took it a step further. So it allows the members committee to approve or reject tariff amendments, to approve or reject the market implementation rules, so the things that aren't necessarily filed with FERC, but govern how that tariff is implemented in the program. And it allowed them to do that without input of the board. So the market participants could, through this committee, make these decisions. The only caveat was that if a stakeholder objected to that decision, it could appeal to the board, and the board would take an independent look at it. It wouldn't have to side with the stakeholder or the participants. It would look at all the information in front of it and make a decision. But absent that appeal, the members have the ability to make those decisions on their own behalf. FERC was comfortable with this because there is the backstop of independent board action, but it is that degree of direct local control that we were hoping to have for our program. In addition to that, FERC allowed membership on that committee to actually be limited to program participants. So there wasn't a need for broader stakeholder participation. FERC allowed this because an interested stakeholder can pay the membership fee. If they meet the membership requirements, they can join. But it is not required that you have your stakeholder committee be open to any and all willing participants. So that also lined up with our goal to have, a degree of strong local control over our program. So that was good news for us. We got that order in, I believe, December, and so we're able to incorporate it into our thinking going forward. Next slide, please. So taking all that into consideration, we went to utility executives, and they gave us the go-ahead to move forward with Option Bravo. So this was, and doing so, modified based on that FERC order. So this was to have an independent board governing the resource adequacy program, but with a strong members committee. So under that model, the independent board of directors would have the ability to hire and fire staff, set budgets, provide all the policy direction for the program. They'd be able to recommend amendments to the member services agreement. Basically, any utility that wants to be part of the RA program would sign on through a member services agreement and then be subject to the terms and conditions of the tariff. The member committee would have substantive control over the amendments to the program itself and amendments to the implementing rules. So we would take that guidance directly from the FERC order and make sure that the participating utilities had that degree of control over the program. Additionally, to give greater comfort to folks that would be worried about scope creep or additional FERC jurisdiction or even an independent board that becomes a little too independent, we have the ability in either charter documents or the tariff itself to set some limitations on board authority. So, for example, being explicit that the board did not have control over generation and transmission assets, that it wasn't supposed to take on transmission planning functions, couldn't override existing resource adequacy requirements for utilities that are in states that have those. So this is generally to get at the concern that the independent board likes what it's doing so much, it decides, let's just go all the way and be an RTO and bring everybody along with us. So that that protection can be in place to make sure it moves at the speed that we want it to move at. That said, there is some real consideration in the region for making sure that we designed this in a way that if we collectively wanted to move in that direction, that we can, and an independent board would allow us to do that as well. And then finally, to the extent one is necessary, even though we're not starting a market, something like an independent market monitor may be useful for making sure that the program is implemented in a fair fashion. So when we talk about governance, we've got the governing and the governed, and so just wanted to run through who those folks might be. For the independent board of directors, there are a few options. This program is started under the auspices of the Northwest Power Pool. It's a good forum. It's utilities that have been working together. It is the region we started focused on. And there's been a desire for the Power Pool to have a role going forward after this is designed. That would take some reforming of the current Power Pool board. It's not set up currently to meet FERC's independence requirements. There may be some other structural changes needed. We are exploring that. At the same time, making sure that we are protecting the existing programs. We get a lot of value out of the existing programs, particularly the reserve sharing and frequency response sharing groups. We want to make sure that if we do move forward with the Power Pool in this role, that we don't inadvertently harm those programs. There's also the possibility of having an existing board take on this role. For example, if we hired Southwest Power Pool or Mid-Continent ISO or California ISO to run it, that you could also have them just be the governing organization. That one's less attractive to most of the participants, particularly because of the local control concerns. You'd be shifting control to an organization outside the region, but it is a possibility. And then finally, there's the greenfield option of just creating a new corporate entity that would have an independent board that would hire staff and would begin to contract for this program. Participants are, at this point, utilities, the balancing authority area utilities, and a handful of larger load-serving entities like Snohomish PUD and EWEB. But it is expected that when the program is started, that it would have to be open to load-serving entities. They are the logical compliance point for matching a resource to load. That's their obligation. And as we've looked at it, there's really not an easy or efficient way, or potentially even legally supportable way, to have the balancing authorities take on that role and take on that responsibility. There's an open question about whether we could make that broader if others were willing to pay the cost of joining. The expectation is that most wouldn't be willing to do that. The benefit of doing so isn't that great. Even though they could participate in the members committee, if there was an adverse decision, they always had the ability to appeal to the board. One other note on load serving entities. We have Bonneville Power Administration as a participant, and of course they bring unique challenges and opportunities to these efforts. BPA will probably be the responsible entity for all of its full requirements customers. So their contract requires them to meet all the needs of those full requirements customers, which makes them look enough like an LSE that it would probably work for them to take on that role. Whereas for their partial requirements and slice block customers, it would be left up to them individually. And a lot of those customers are the large ones already participating in the program. State regulators are an interesting and another open question. Each state has different approaches to resource adequacy, different degrees of involvement in the question. And so we are considering ways to make sure that they are informed and involved without having them be involved to a degree that state regulators are taking over the program or superseding the desires of the participants. Resource decisions are left to states under the Federal Power Act. So it is their area of expertise as opposed to wholesale markets and transmission, which are left to FERC under the Federal Power Act. In ISOs and RTOs, the state regulators have varying degrees of input. Some have committees where they have voting rights that can influence board decisions, and others just have advisory committees where they meet and discuss and make recommendations. So we continue to explore that, and we'll try to come up with a solution that balances the interest of the regulated utilities and the public power community. Then finally, there will always be other stakeholders, like I mentioned, consumer advocacy groups, environmental groups, things of that nature. And so we will make sure that we have an appropriate avenue for communication, because as always, these programs are most successful when we have collaboration and can work towards consensus. Next slide. So next steps, as I mentioned, we've got a pretty tight timeline. I know that a year can be tight just for two-party contracts on things much simpler than this. So we've got a lot of work ahead of us to finalize the structure, but also get it written up, get all the supporting documents in place, and make sure that we can get that filed on time. So even though we've talked about the high level of the structure, there are still a lot of detail to work out around committees, committee membership, committee charters, voting rights and voting weighting, dispute resolution and exit provisions. When things go sideways, how are we going to address that? And it's going to be an important consideration for all participants. Once we get everything in place, we have to hire a market operator. So this is going to be the person that takes all those governing or tariff documents and implementation rules and turns the crank and makes the program work. Right now, the Northwest Power Pool doesn't have the staff to accommodate that sort of activity. So we've been looking into how we go about identifying people that are both qualified and interested and would be acceptable to the regional participants. So this will likely be an existing ISO or RTO, somebody like Southwest Power Pool or MISO, but we need to get a process in place to make sure we've got the best and most cost-effective entity to run that for us. And then finally, we have to actually get FERC approval to be up and running by our target date of March 2023. So with all that, if there are any additional questions, that's what we had for you today. And like Steve mentioned, we will be back with additional updates on the program as it goes forward. Commissioner Congdon, I saw a hand up.
Oh, hi. Thanks, Rob. Great job. That was a good presentation. So I am feeling better about governance. Should I be? I mean, I like the sound. I keep hearing a focus on local control throughout, and I like that.
You should be feeling better about it. And I would say it really is do that FERC order. We were looking in this working group at how we were going to avoid a lot of the pitfalls that we ran into with the MC initiative. A lot of people participating were heavily involved in that as well. And really that tension between maintaining local control, but also not having utility participant voices diluted by other stakeholders was going to be a tricky problem to solve. And the SPP order really gave us some clear direction that we can have strong limits. The piece that's going to help us with that is having independent oversight, a board that can be appealed to, but there's not a requirement that that board have direct decisional authority on everything that is done. And so that, I think, will help us achieve a balance that maintains local focus and also maintains utility focus, so that the people that actually have resources at stake or load service at stake are the ones driving the direction of the program.
Yeah, no, that does sound tricky. A difficult balance to achieve that. That sounds really good. Thank you.
Sure.
Commissioners, if I could add one other point to Rob's really excellent description of this. No doubt that the Southwest Power Pool order is giving us a lot more comfort with respect to how a governance structure could be formed that would take the interests of public power utilities into account. There is another issue here as well, which is as we move towards a clean energy implementation, legislation implementation, lots more variable energy resources on the system, just to try to maintain reliability in the system is going to require a lot more sharing across utilities than has historically happened, which means you need some sort of mechanism to have that sharing be in place. There, candidly, is a lot more concern, similar to the concerns that we have expressed in the past about the CAISO governance structure, and that if we may be needing to move towards a model that will allow more sharing to occur, that there's more interest in there being a Northwest model for that and not just being reliant on a California model to make this happen. And so it's another factor that's pushing folks in public power to be more open to this concept than maybe it was back in 03 and 04 when we were discussing RTO West and Grid West, and 2013 when we were discussing what was called the Northwest Power Pool MC effort. So times have changed, and we're all evolving some here, and we're seeing a lot more consensus about moving forward with this program than we saw with either of those previous two efforts.
So, Steve, recognizing that a lot of Northwest utilities have moved into the California ISO, would the formation of this potentially pull them back into a different organization?
You know, Rob's been in there talking to these folks, so I'm going to let him respond to that.
Sure. So this is not likely to do that. It is a completely different focus. That said, there's been really from the beginning an acknowledgement that if we do this right and if we have a big win on this, that it will give us momentum for moving this program to something more than just resource adequacy. So we'll have a better frame for revisiting either an organized market or something related to that in the Northwest. That might be attractive to get people to move back. I think that combined with what we saw this summer in California and the political reaction to it would probably be a little bit more of an impetus as well. So Steve mentioned the California governance, and we have been very involved commenting on that. A lot of our comments were brushed aside by the California parties that, you know, this isn't, sure, it's set up as a political animal, but that's not how it's going to operate until things get pretty desperate, and then that's exactly how it operates. And we're starting to see elements of that in the way they reacted to their blackouts and some of their proposals going forward, that it's really just unavoidable that when the dollars get high enough, the politicians are going to move, and that if there is a viable alternative to that, then it will be attractive for those utilities to come home to. So we're not setting out to build that viable alternative, but it is, we want to make sure that we're set up in a way we could move to that without a lot of cost or heartache.
You know, I'd like to add one other quick thought to this. Back in December, I was asked to join three other entities to make a presentation to the Power Pool board about how the members really felt that there needs to be a change to the governance of the board. That it's a long history to how the board got to where it is, but it really is not set up for longevity, even if we weren't going to make any changes, and particularly if we're talking about making changes like this that could result in a FERC jurisdictional program, it absolutely needs change. And I proposed three principles, which the other parties agreed to. The other parties were Bonneville and two investor-owned utilities. The first was, we want to do no harm. The Northwest Power Pool runs some really good programs. Rob described those. The reserve sharing program, frequency response sharing program, are very valuable to utilities across the region. They keep us from having to build much more generating resources, and so it's a substantial benefit. Number two is, make sure that the governance structure that we put in place will be sustainable, that it's going to go to FERC and we're going to be successful there, because there are other efforts that have been put on around the country where entities went back three and four times. That is really time-consuming, and time-consuming is expensive. And we need a resource adequacy program soon in the Northwest to reflect the concerns that are out there. third one, though, was that this be set up in a fashion, the governance structure be set up in a fashion where if the Northwest decided it wanted to move to an RTO, it wouldn't require a significant change in the governance structure, that it would actually have the capability to be able to work. That's not saying we've made up our minds we want to go there, but it's trying to keep an option open, particularly because if the frustration in the Northwest grows with the existing ISO, the CAISO, that there would be the capability to be able to move quickly to create a Northwest entity in order to be able to make it work. And again, those other entities endorse those principles as well. So I think there is evidence out there that that even those folks who are participating in the CAISO EIM want to have options. They want to have another alternative because, as Rob suggested, the California response to the blackouts has only significantly increased the level of concern, not just in the Northwest, but in the desert Southwest as well, about participating in a market that is controlled by a set of California politicians.
Thank you. Great presentation, Rob. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And I would like to take a moment just to, with the board here, thank Rob. He's been our interim managing director since I can't remember when, but sometime August, September?
October 5th.
October 5th, okay.
Today is 6 months exactly.
And
he's counting.
And he's not done yet. We do anticipate announcing a new managing director for energy resources this afternoon. But that person is going to take some time to get here, so Rob's going to be it for probably another 6 weeks or so. He's just been fabulous. It's been so good to have him in this job, and I just want you to know, the board to know, that it's been very comforting to have someone with Rob's talent doing this work for us.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
I'd like to echo that. Thank you very much, Rob, for all your hard work.
Yeah. Thank you. All right, so Steve, advanced meters.
Yeah, we want to give you an update on advanced metering infrastructure. And we are moving towards, there are no decisions today for the board, but we are moving towards a resolution that will be coming forward and hopefully not too distant future. Katie Marshall will be giving this presentation.
Good morning, commissioners. I'm Katie Marshall. I've been leading the AMI efforts at the district for about the last year now. As Steve mentioned, contract negotiations are nearing completion, so it seemed like an ideal time to circle back with the board and provide an overview of the efforts that have occurred to date, as well as some more detail around the selected solution and associated contract scope. And so, as this slide's showing, it kind of covers those items we just discussed, and Steve also said there's no board action requested today. Some of the efforts to date that I want to highlight start with just the customer outreach and research efforts that occurred early on in this project that were followed by the board approval of AMI as the future of customer metering. Some of the efforts that followed that were the publication of the RFP, selection of the vendor, and then early last year, the board also approved the AMI opt-out policy. Some of the other upcoming efforts include completing the contract negotiations, project kickoff, as well as establishing some protocol around AMI meter-based repairs and determining how to handle things such as meter access issues. I wanted to kind of provide a tie back to how AMI fits into the district's overall vision and strategic plan. AMI directly ties to the district's strategic priority number one, specifically to improving our customer service technology. Within that, smart meters are called out as a customer service technology that provides opportunity to improve our retail electric services. AMI really is a foundational technology for other customer service technologies as well. On the next slide here, I'll just provide a quick overview of some of those benefits that AMI provides. This is actually showing you a snapshot of the advanced meter subpage of the district's internet site. It highlights some of the customer benefits and advanced offerings that are achieved by AMI implementation. Specifically, they're talking about restoring power faster after an outage, as well as giving customers information to help make better decisions about their power usage, or more informed decisions, I guess. I've also provided a link there to that subpage, which gives quite a bit more information too for those that may be looking for it. Just to provide a little bit of an overview on the selected solution, it's a combination of two vendors. One is Itron, which is really kind of the product that we've selected. They have the meters, they manufacture the meters, the equipment, as well as provide the associated software. And that's coupled with Anixter, who is our implementation partner. Anixter will really help us to onboard and support us through development of the new system. In that process. One of the key determinants in the vendor selection that the district made was Itron is really a proven AMI technology. At the end of 2018, about 70% of US electric meters were have been upgraded to advanced meters, and that number has just continued to grow since then. So of that 70%, Itron has 63% of that U.S. market share. So they really are a proven technology in this arena. They also continue to invest, you can see there, in R&D annually to keep improving and expanding their capabilities. There's some other items listed there, too, that at a high level just go through what went into the district selection of this solution. One other point I wanted to make on that slide, too, is just some neighboring utilities who have also implemented the Itron system include Grant PUD, Avista, City of Richland, and then maybe not so close to home, but some larger utilities also include PacifiCorp, Pacific Gas and Electric, and SMUD. As far as the contract scoping goes, it's been a pretty extensive district effort that has gone into scoping this contract. There's been numerous district resources as well as third-party contractors that have worked on the scope. The contract is pretty large and complex due to the broad range of things covered within it. Certain elements of that include procurement of the meters and the network equipment, the head-end system software, hosting of that software and support, installation services for the meters and the network, as well as professional services, which could include configurations, training, that type of work. I wanted to give a high-level overview as well of the project budget and timeline. This is still in alignment with what was provided at the beginning of kind of the introduction of AMI and what we thought that might look like here. So the total project budget is around $15 million, which is included in the 2021 budget approval. A large portion of that is the contract we were just speaking to. Other elements of that also include district labor, third-party support, material overhead, that type of thing. As a high-level project overview, the project's broken into four different phases, which occur over a time frame of about 27 months, really beginning with just planning, technical architecture, network design, which then lead into really the system configurations and integrations. And then next into just deploying a small amount of meters and making sure that that all works with the systems that have been set up, followed by a full year of really deploying meters across the county. I'm going to turn it over to Neil Nouritzos to discuss the communications plan and other outreach efforts that have occurred.
Great. Thank you, Katie. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes, Neil.
Okay, good. Thanks. Neil Nouritzos, communications manager for Chelan PD. And I'm just going to go over kind of where we've been and where we're going in the next several months going into 2021 and 2022. So in 2017 and 2018, we held about 18 community meetings. We did some mailers out to the community, and we were out at service clubs and city councils for a range of updates and got a lot of good input, I know, during that process. I wasn't here at the time, but I've seen a lot of the materials that came out of that. I got a really robust set of FAQs. We did a lot of fact sheets and that sort of thing, and did a lot of research about different issues that customers had raised. So moving forward into late last year, we started to look at a lot of those FAQs, look at some gaps that maybe were out there and seeing what we could do to make those more robust. We took another look at our website and added some features. And then going forward, we'll be looking at some outreach through newsletters and through some fact sheets and those sorts of things to make sure that we've got a really solid set of materials for our customers for any questions that come up. One of the things that really benefits us is that there's some really good best practices out there we've been looking at throughout the region. Katie mentioned Grant PUD. I think there's a real advantage to them being in our area and using the same vendor. We've met with their communications staff and talked through some issues that worked for them, and they had a pretty smooth rollout, it sounds like. So we'll continue to do that, look at different utilities and see, for example, if there are certain questions that come up frequently with other utilities and we don't have FAQs, we can develop those as we go along. One of the things we'll be doing is creating what we call a learning center. And this is the section of our website that's got all these materials. What we want to do is direct people initially to that for questions. We'll have, obviously, people calling into our customer relations department. We'll be having people sending us emails through our website and other means. But we want to make sure that's robust and it's got all the answers that people maybe have questions about. So one of the things we'll do, for example, is create a couple of videos that will show people what the meter installers look like, what the process looks like, and then also provide some information about the benefits of advanced metering. As questions come in, some of those questions obviously will be fielded fairly easily. I think we'll get a sense of some general questions that people have. But if need be, we'll have our communication staff handle some of the questions if they get more technical in nature, or if we need to bring in a subject matter expert. So, for example, someone in the metering area might need to come in and ask answer a technical question as needed, and we'll communications will be kind of the channel that will initially come through after the initial calls. As we move toward deployment, we'll do a series of notices to customers 60 days out, 10 days prior, and then the day of the install. And that'll be a combination of mailers and door hangers. So, again, a lot of good information out there from other utilities that have implemented AMI, and we'll look to them to learn from their successes and the challenges they may have had as we develop our communications. So with that, I'll turn it back to Katie.
Thanks, Neil. So to summarize on this, the next steps for us are completing the contract negotiations. There really are only a handful of issues that are still open that we're working on negotiating. I anticipate hopefully coming back then to the board in the near future with a resolution for the contract approval. And then following that would be scheduling the project kickoff meeting. So I just want to open it up to questions that you may have based on kind of the updated information we've provided.
So when do we anticipate having all the meters installed?
So that would be 27 months then from the kickoff of the project. So if we were to able, it would, I think that puts us right around mid-year 2023.
Thank you. Any other questions? Nice presentation. Thank you. It was very thorough.
Thank you.
Okay, commissioners, we've hit the end of our morning study session items, but we have a few minutes left, and I think it might make sense to go back to the discussion that Eric Wolkist is going to lead for us around sole source contracts, particularly given Commissioner Congdon's comments earlier. That way we can have it in advance of the discussion of the resolutions this afternoon. So I'm going to turn it over to Eric.
Sure. Thanks, Steve. Good morning still, commissioners. So Eric Wolkist, General Counsel. So this is, as mentioned earlier, a topic that we've been looking at here, I would say, as staff a little more frequently later. You probably have noticed, as Commissioner Congdon pointed out, that in your recent board packets, you've seen a slightly increasing number of sole source resolutions for some smaller dollar amounts. That has given us cause to think about maybe a more efficient way to handle sole source resolutions and whether those need to come for those amounts to the board or not. So that is the kickoff point for this conversation. So by way of background, commissioners, our present process, and it's consistent with statute, is that all sole source resolutions purporting to spend more than $60,000 come to the board. The statutes do authorize those contracts under $60,000 to be handled without coming to the board. I would point out that there is a statutory scheme also set out through a combination of statutes, Title 54, 5404-070, and the Public Works Statute, Title 3904-280, that does expressly permit governing bodies such as the board and through Title 54, this body as the district's governing board, to handle sole source resolutions above that $60,000 threshold in one of two ways. The first is the way that we have been handling it, and that is to simply bring them in each instance to the board for a specific discussion and action. The alternative statutory scheme that is set up would allow the board to adopt a way of handling those sole source agreements at some threshold that the board would establish through the adoption of a policy or a process. In the event that the board were to determine to set up that process, there are actually no required steps that the district doesn't already have in place. So we would need to update the delegation resolution, which currently does not speak to delegating authorities for sole source at above $60,000. We would, in the event we chose to update that resolution, need to set the appropriate threshold for where above, so above which those resolutions would still need to come to the board, but like the other procurement methodologies in the delegation resolution, the board would set those thresholds with some input and discussion with staff. And then quite simply, just like we would do in a resolution, we would need to make, upon award, those contracts and the factual justification, therefore, available for public inspection should they members of the public have interest. I will tell the commissioners that we already do that process. We already require, before bringing forward a resolution on a sole source, we do require a sole source justification memo, which is about four questions that the project manager or project team needs to fill out. They fill that out in conjunction with the support groups to include PCS, procurement and contract servicing, legal. It's reviewed by their management team. So there is quite a background process and then discussed at the pre-agenda meeting before it would come forward to ensure that we have met all of the required components or metrics before we could bring forward and justify a sole source contract. Those include things like properly reviewing our specification or the district's need to ensure that the product we're acquiring is one that is a legitimate need. Secondarily, that product or service would be available only legitimately from a single sole source of supply. And then there's some representations that the contractor or the supplier needs to make relative to them offering us the lowest price that they offer all or equal to or lower than what they offer similarly situated purchasers. So you are probably familiar with that memorandum from past resolutions, and you will see a lot of those factual justifications contained in the body of your sole source resolutions that you review already at each meeting, including today. So we would not propose to change any of those protective measures. They would remain in place. The only potential change for consideration is whether the board would be comfortable delegating to Steve, as the general manager, the ability pursuant to 3904-280 to follow a policy and make those sole source decisions or determinations instead of the board up to a particular threshold. That would be the same policy paradigm that we have now. You recall under the board's delegation resolution, Steve has up to $3 million of bid authority, $500,000 of service agreement authority, $500,000 of change order or fieldwork order authority, and then he is redelegated within certain approved limits to executive managers and down through the director and supervisor levels. So I guess that's a long way of saying we're here to say I think that it might be worth, should the board be interested in evaluating whether or not we could find a more efficient way to handle some of these sole source contracts, if the board is comfortable doing so. I think it is a very modest change that I could bring to the board at the next meeting or as soon as the board is ready that would outline that policy. I do not believe that it would require any additional staff or resource time to implement that policy because we already do the reviews to ensure that they are legitimately being brought to the board. And then, of course, all of those contracts and documents as public records are already maintained by PCS and available upon request. So we'll remind you that we did briefly visit that as part of the 2017 delegation conversation. Candidly, there were other bigger fish to fry.
Thank you. So just a little history on this. I was a board member when another board member brought this forward, and I'm not sure we even had a policy at that time, but this particular board member wanted to have every single sole source contractor brought before the board, and the board, so that the board can make the decision. And in looking back, I think it was misguided, and I think we're overdue for, cleaning this up and delegating this to our general manager. Just my thoughts. Thanks.
Okay. Any other thoughts at the moment? Well, we might have a lunch hour to think about it and talk about it under, after the consent agenda, just to give you some feedback.
Happy to have any feedback, commissioners, including outside of this meeting. It's really the start of a conversation, given the trending that I think we've recognized here on the staff side in preparation for these meetings.
Okay. Well, it appears that it's time to recess for lunch, and we will reconvene at 1 o'clock. Welcome to the afternoon session of the April 5, 2021 Public Utility District of Chelan County Commission meeting. This afternoon is a business session. This morning we met in study session. I reminded all participants this morning to please place their computers or devices on mute when not speaking to minimize background interference. I noticed early on, but not for very long, I should have also mentioned if you're have your computer on, please silence your phone, because I heard a phone ring that I thought was my own. As it turns out, it wasn't. Somebody else has my Cricket ring. So anyway, just a reminder for people to keep all your devices on mute or silent, if you would, please. This afternoon, our first item on our agenda is the consent agenda, and this morning we modified the consent agenda to include resolutions 10, 11, 12, 13, and 14. So is there a motion to approve the consent agenda, including all resolutions up to number 14?
So moved. Mr. Chairman, then I'll second the motion.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda as presented. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the consent agenda has been approved. And we are to item 15. Steve Wright.
Commissioners, before we go to item 15, we want to introduce a subject that will hopefully help item 15 move along. Maybe it's just me that's having difficulty in understanding where we are in these processes when we're doing design build, but I have to admit there are times in which I'm not quite sure where we are and what decision is being made. And what Eric and Dan Frazier have been working on is a diagram that helps describe the different points where there are decisions and particularly where the board needs to make a decision, which I think will also help with item 15 to explain what the action is that we're taking here today. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Eric and Dan.
Thanks, Steve. This is Dan Frazier, Director of Shared Services. I'll turn my camera on. Good afternoon, Commissioners. About a year and a half ago, Brett Bickford and I did a little presentation because we were starting to see more and more of these what we call alternative procurements occurring. And we gave a kind of a broad overview of both the GCCM and the design build. What I'd like to do today is get a little more detail around when the board is going to see different things, and especially when they differ from what we are typically seeing in what our historical method of design bid build usually entails as far as coming to the board. So this process, as we've been now probably about 2.5 years into using this process, we're learning more about it. EPM is learning more about it. We've got some good experts that are helping us out. But it really starts with, as this slide shows kind of on the far left there, the decision to use the design build process. And there's lots of acronyms.
Dan, what's EPM?
Oh, I'm sorry, Engineering Project Management. Of course, I missed one of the acronyms. I was just going to say, I gave a little log of a legend of all the acronyms because we are an acronym-rich group, and it helped get the slide, everything on one slide, actually. So EPM, Engineering Project Management, they are the project managers, the engineers are going to build these projects. And then my group, PCS, we're the procurement group, and so we work together to make that decision on when we would use this type of procurement, whether it's design build or even GCCM. We'll just call them alternative procurements. At that point, usually a presentation is made to the board. So you see the red diamond is every time we would stop in at the board. And as a presentation, we don't have to have approval at that point, but we are usually going to the state, to the PRC, that's the Project Review Committee, and they're going to review our project and say whether we can or cannot use that system. So far, I believe we have been 5 times and we are 5-0. So I think we do a really good job of showing that we know what the process is and we have good projects that make sense to use these processes. Then before we advertise the request for qualifications, we would come to the board and get that authorized by the board to request qualifications. Sometimes we will do those two steps together. The first two diamonds there, we'll bring those to the board together. Now, one of the reasons for confusion about this is there's words, there's nomenclature around this process or these processes that differ quite a bit from the design bid build process, and some of them use the same names and the same acronyms, and that's where I think people get confused. They have different words with different meanings, but they also use some of the same words. So in here we use a request for qualifications, which is kind of ubiquitous around our world, but those would go out, contractors would then respond, and we would evaluate those qualifications, their statements of qualifications there. And then we'd advertise a request for proposal, and that request for proposal is similar to like what a bid is, but it's really their entire package of what those contractors who were shortlisted through the RFQ process can give us information about what they would be proposing when working with this part of this process. We evaluate those proposals, and we have what's called proprietary meetings. So in this type of work that we're doing, we're having the contractor help us design. So they may have some proprietary information that we want to know about in order to help make the decision, but they may not want the rest of the world knowing about. So we have, that's something specific to the design build process, that we have these proprietary meetings. Through that process, we make our selection, we negotiate the DBA, the design build agreement, and that is the overall contract framework that includes all the terms and conditions. It includes how we're going to pay them, and it does not include the actual construction work. It's really the big framework we're working around. It frequently includes a scope of work for design, and so we usually have what's called pre-construction services as part of that design build agreement. When Sam and I brought the GCCM contract for Rock Island in two plus years ago, that was a couple $100,000 of pre-construction services, which was then later brought into a bigger project with the GMP, which I'll get to in a minute, of a much bigger project. But the initial contract is very small in relative terms to the overall project. So we come to the board and they authorize execution of the design build agreement. Then the teams get together, go through the design process, and they finalize the design, and that's what they're working today. You see the gold star there. We are here. This is what Devin is going to be presenting today, which is what's called a GMP amendment. And this is really when the terms get confusing. So the term GMP is a guaranteed maximum price. The GMP is a scope of work, and in that scope of work, the contractor has given us a price for that scope of work. So we call that the guaranteed maximum price, and it's associated with a certain scope. We amend the DBA, the design build agreement that was executed previously, and we add this work into the contract. So now we have an executed contract and the scope of work, the construction that we plan on doing in this case. And that's what we're doing here today. Devin will talk about. So that's kind of how a lot of the projects go. You execute the GMP and then boom, they go off and they start building, and it just keeps working that way. What I've blown up here in this lower section is what can happen during construction. So field work order change order, same term we use for our design bid build projects, is a change to the GMP. So we're out digging in the ground and we discover a fuel tank. Oh, we didn't know there was a fuel tank in the ground, so now we're going to pay the contractor to remediate a fuel tank. That would be a field work order to the GMP. They guaranteed their price with everything they knew, but if the scope changes, we would change the contract to allow them to be paid for removal of the fuel tank. Also, during this time, we may schedule this, we may plan this, or something may come up where we want to add a second GMP or additional work that's outside of the original scope. Then we would initiate a GMP amendment number 2. So this is what we did on the service center project. We came in and did a site work package, and that was GMP 1. And then we came in later and did the building package, which is GMP 2. What this allows us to do in a structured way is to get going on those things that we do know while we're still designing the things that have yet to be completed, but they aren't going to affect the first phase of work. So it's a really good way to structure vertical construction, because we always have that site work work to do before you start vertical construction. So, and then that, as you go down the line there, you could continue on that do loop of adding work, and then if you amend the work, you do a field work order change order to the GMP. So we don't do a GMP amendment to a GMP, we do a field work order change order. So this is kind of that overall process that you get through that gets in the end to a completed project, but it is confusing. It does differ from the way we do typical design bid build projects, but we're seeing a lot of value in doing it this way. It does take a lot of upfront work. So if you notice that the first 5 or 6 sections there, the decision to use all the way through the negotiate DBA, that's usually done before we go out to bid. In a design bid build, we do that all in-house, and then we just advertise. So there is quite a bit more work up front, but we think we see big benefit on the backside and during construction. Any questions?
Dan, would you take a second and just describe, we've got long lead time components as part of this GMP amendment that's coming forward to today, and how that fits into this process relative to the scope of work for the entire work on the draft tube?
Yeah, that's a great example, Steve. I actually should use that one. very often during the types of construction we do, we have long lead items. So what you're able to do is create its own guarantee maximum price for those long lead items. So you can still be working on maybe the construction work, but you know we're going to need these. And I'm not sure exactly what the items that Devin's working with today, but I've been on projects where some electrical equipment may be a year out, 6 months out. So you can order that. You can have that separate scope of work that's just getting the equipment here, and then you can keep working on the design and negotiating price on the labor part of it or additional materials and labor. So in this case, we're just planning to break it up into a couple of GMPs, and so that's a great way to use this process to do that.
Looks like
any questions for Dan?
President Smith, I have a question.
Sure.
Dan, this is Gary Arsenault. My question is actually there's two pieces to the question. We've seen a dramatic increase in raw material cost. I was just chatting with someone yesterday who's got a dairy farm and trying to do some expansion using steel construction, and his cost of steel and beams is making it almost impossible for him to do his construction building. Have we seen that impact our project? And if so, how does the GMP deal with things like that?
So I can't speak to Devin's project, but I can definitely speak to the service center project. So as we were moving through final design, we accelerated our bid time frame because we saw the steel prices starting to ramp up. Obviously, a significant amount of steel in all of those buildings out there, and it had the potential to really upset the budget. It's one of those budget breakers. So we were able to kind of rush the last little bit to get it out to bid, and our bid still came in nearly $3 million over our estimated cost for steel on the project. And so we do lock in prices at that time. So that is why we rush to get it done, because as soon as we have a bid, we've locked in prices. If we were to delay the project, however, there would be ramifications on delay. So there are ways to escalate costs. And most of our big projects that we do manufacturing, like for our turbine runner projects or where they're casting turbine blades, depending on when we would execute that work and give them the notice to proceed, the cost would escalate based on what the market did between their bid and the time we give them notice to proceed on the work. So so in this case, because we didn't build in that, we didn't think we'd have any delay time, we actually have a locked-in price for the steel on that project.
Commissioner, I might add another example that we haven't had a chance to talk with the board about, but the delivery has been a problem as well. And we have a delay in with respect to the delivery of steel for the Rocky Reach facilities project. It was about a four-month delay, and that's having an impact on the schedule there. It might even be a day-for-day impact on the schedule. So, yes, we are seeing challenges both with price and availability.
Any other questions? Well, Dan, it is not a simple process.
The district has really benefited from these processes. I know definitely on the service center. I don't know how we would have done that project without this added ability to cooperate and plan and design with our builder on board. These kind of complex projects, they just don't build themselves. And you can go in with a great design team, but they're not the ones building it. So having this ability to have this interaction with your builder early in the project has been just paramount to success of these projects.
Well, I was out there a few days ago, and it's impressive what's going on out there. It really is.
It's good to see. I came in from the north last night, coming back into town, and said, well, there we can see kind of what the corner of that building is going to look like and how massive it is to the skyline when it does get completed.
Yeah.
Commissioners, with that, I think we might turn to Devin, but I would remind you, we did have a presentation on this overall project a few weeks ago, so it's not not new to the board. And for that reason, I'm going to ask Devin to go through this in a summary fashion and really just try to focus on what specifically is happening with this GMP amendment. So, Devin, hey, up to you.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. Yeah, and I appreciate Dan and Eric's work on explaining that. That took some of the stuff out of what I was going to try to do, so that's great. My name is Devin Myers. I am a project manager down at Rock Island, and I'm here today to talk to you about a resolution to request a guaranteed maximum price amendment for long lead procurement items to North Bank Civil and Marine for the Rock Island Powerhouse 2 draft tube gate cylinder and hydraulic power unit upgrade, and also to adopt a capital budget revision for this project. For this project, we are using the progressive design build procurement method that Dan just explained, and for all 8 units down at Powerhouse 2. The procurement method is authorized under RCW 3910, which allows us to use alternative procurement methods. The evaluated price for the work proposed by North Bank is approximately $7.5 million to complete all 8 units by the end of 2024. And the work that we're doing, it's the hydraulic cylinders, replacing the HPUs, also doing some controls upgrades for our draft tube gate system, and refurbishing the cylinder support structures, as well as replacing some piping. The long lead procurement that we're talking about here today, so the district entered into a design build contract with North Bank in February of 2021. This included authorization of pre-construction services to finalize the technical specifications, complete the design process, and establish schedules and guaranteed maximum price amendments for long lead procurement, as well as the first draft tube gate systems. Pre-construction to this point has focused primarily on the design of the hydraulic cylinders and the HPUs due to the long lead time required to manufacture these components. This long lead GMP will authorize North Bank to procure materials and manufacture 2 sets of hydraulic cylinders and 2 hydraulic power units, and expedite the installation schedule for installing by installing 1 draft tube gate system this fall and 1 early next 2022. We're requesting authorization to execute GMP amendment number 1 in the amount of $1,234,365. The pre-construction phase will continue until May 4th and deliver the final design, installation work plans, and the project schedules. We will seek board approval for future work and GMP through GMP amendments. So we'll be back as this progress, as we finish through the pre-construction and move through this project. In addition, this resolution is also to authorize a capital budget revision to move the funding source for the draft tube gate project from operations and maintenance budget to the capital fund, adopting the project capital budget. The charter for this project was approved in July of 2019 and the business case in March of 2020. The project was originally budgeted at O&M due to the refurbishment of existing equipment. However, it's become apparent through the design build process that this work would include replacement of most of the equipment and needs to be paid for through a capital budget. The budget funding of $2.7 million was originally approved as O&M and needs to be changed to capital over the next 4 years. The approved business case budget for 2021 was $900,000 and budgeted O&M. The capital funds needed in this year is $2.2 million, and this will include the funding for the pre-construction and 2 unit draft tube gate systems. So thank you for your time. I tried to be brief.
Are there any questions?
Questions for Devin. You know, Devin, I have one that you may or may not be able to answer. As you talked about converting this from O&M to capital project, the question emerged in my mind, why it happened or even originally to be in O&M versus the capital budget. And I don't know if you're...
Yeah. I can, because that's kind of how this... One of the reasons I really enjoy using the design build process is that going into this project, we kind of left it open to, like, we could either refurbish the cylinders or do we need to replace them? Thinking in our minds that probably refurbishment might be a cheaper way to go. But after we got into the proposal phase and like Dan talked about proprietary meetings with some of the manufacturers, it became apparent that the price difference wasn't huge, A, and B, schedule risk mitigation by having all new was the way to go. So, you know, we kind of originally go, oh, you build something new, it's going to cost 50, 75% more, and it really wasn't like that at all. And that same with the hydraulic power units. And so then we went back and I talked to our finance people and we just kind of revisited it. And they agreed that we should probably go capital on this because it's replacing new equipment versus refurbishing. So the option was there when we started this process to go either way. And so I think we were leaning O&M because we thought it would be more that way, but that's part of the beauty is you talk to the experts and they kind of let you know as well. So,
okay. Good explanation. Thank you.
Yep. I have another project coming that generator leads that started off O&M and is staying O&M. So, but I had okay. I had to go ask the same questions on that one as well.
Okay, very good. Any other questions from my fellow commissioners? If not, is there a motion to approve resolution number 15?
This is Steve. I'll make the motion to approve resolution number 15.
I'll second the motion.
It's been moved and seconded to approve resolution 15. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 And opposed? Motion is carried.
Thank you.
You bet. Thank you, Devin.
Uh-huh.
Steve, we're down to manager's items.
We are. So I would like to invite Ryan Baker. I'm hoping he's on to give you an update on the Parks Reservation System.
Thank you, Steve. Good afternoon, commissioners. Ryan Baker, Parks Manager here for the Chelan County PUD. Just wanted to provide you guys with a brief update on the Parks Reservation System. So the reservation system is for BB Bridge Park, our shelters, and our ball fields. As a reminder, BB Bridge Campground was first come, first served prior to this year. Back in March 24th at 10 o'clock a.m., we launched our new reservation system. Within the first 24 hours, we had over 1,000 reservations that were made for BB. So it was quite the day. The prime season, roughly Memorial Day through Labor Day, was sold out in a matter of hours. We had about 2,200 phone calls that day, trying to help customers create accounts and understand how the software works. That said, we're asking for patience and understanding as this is a very new system and we are experiencing lots of aches and pains. Some of the issues we're dealing with are around senior and disabled vet discounts and reservations spanning the off season to the prime season. An interesting statistic I wanted to share with you folks is about 90 ratepayers have made reservations at BB Bridge Campground, which makes up about 8.8% of the total reservations that are customer owners. And the vast majority of the folks that have made reservations are from the west side of Washington State. Lastly, we have not forgotten about the PPP pilot program. That's still on our radars. We just need to work through a few of the bugs in our reservation system. And after we do that, we'll be coming back to the commission with a proposal on how to move forward. So that said, I'll pause to see if there are any questions, comments, or concerns about the reservation system.
Commissioners?
Ryan, you may want to add something about revenue generated.
Ah, yes. Good point, Steve. So you may recall back at our last parks update, we talked about revenue and actual the nights and the cost of a campsite. We bumped up from $30 to $35. That $5 covers the reservation fee, if you will, and it's included in the night's camping fees. And in that number that I spoke to about the, roughly, 1,000 reservations that were made. In the first day, we saw over $110,000 in revenue. And so you can imagine that was a very busy day for us. And quite frankly, we're still figuring out, the reconciliation reports with internal audit, and nobody expected that great of registrations in one day. So, yeah.
And if I understand correctly, last year we made $140,000 for the entire year, or something like that?
Yeah, that's about average, Steve, and commissioners. That, it really depends upon weather is a big factor, whether or not we have wildfires. But last year's revenue, even with COVID, was right around, I think, $140,000 to $145,000. We also do charge for dump fees. So if you're not staying with us in the campground and you just kind of pass by the campground and want to use our dump station, we charge $6 for that. So that number is also reflected in the $145,000 annual revenue fees.
So I think what it appears we're seeing is what will turn out to be higher usage, which is to some extent probably due to the reservation system. If people know that they're going to be able to get a campsite, then they're more likely to come. And it's possible the reservation system may actually lead to a higher level of revenue. We'll see how this plays out, but it's off to a good start for sure.
Yeah, that's a great point, Steve. And, one of the frustrating things that we saw were families sitting in line 8 to 10 hours a day. We would see a line actually out to the road at times, and knowing that we didn't have enough turnaround as far as enough sites available, and trying to walk that line and explain it to some families, and they would still, some of them would still sit in line and kind of wait till 10 o'clock at night. So this reservation system, you're right, Steve, will not only probably increase revenue, but folks that decide to travel up to BB will know if they have a site or not. And certainly that'll help on the front lines with our folks dealing with the issues and in the lines and things that come with first come, first serve.
Gary.
Thank you. Thanks, Ryan. Great report. A couple questions for you. Is there a maximum stay at BB under this reservation system?
Yes. In fact, we implemented that rule change this year, Commissioner. We saw in the past some folks staying with us for months on end, and so there is a maximum of 21 days that can be stayed in any calendar year, and that's fairly consistent with state parks and other folks that run campgrounds.
Thank you. A thought just occurs to me, and I don't know if there's any validity to this. You may have already done a research study on this, but I'm a little shocked by how few Chelan County residents are represented by the numbers you gave us. 91%, over 91%, came from west of the state. Have you looked at providing maybe a window, a week or so, that Chelan County residents would have an opportunity to reserve and then open it up to the general public?
That is a great question, and one that we have been talking about as we would come back to the commission when we would talk about maybe the PPB or moving forward with that program. And yes, we have talked about that. We have talked about maybe a week or two window, that exactly what you described, where Chelan County residents would have, I don't know if priority is the word, but would have the ability to get on and book sites prior to opening it to the general public. So I'm confident we'll have a recommendation here soon. When we do our lessons learned, I think, from this reservation system, something like that likely will be in there, so that we give folks the opportunity to you know, make a reservation. One of the difficult things about launching the reservation system is we had a very old antiquated system where we wrote on envelopes, if you will, and we had names, but we didn't have a great way to reach out our typical stakeholder engagement to let folks know we'll be, you know, changing. It was a lot of word of mouth and a lot of folks, you know, calling and contacting us and letting them know this change. But I'm glad you asked that question, and that is something we're looking at very closely.
Great. Thank you. Yeah, I'd like to be kept apprised of any decisions or movement in that direction. Thank you.
Dennis, you had a question?
No, I have a comment. Last Thursday, I was directly asked, Ryan, about when are you guys going to repair the tennis courts and stripe those things for pickleball? And I said, well, it's nice that you asked that question. I said in our one of our last board meetings, Ryan Baker, who manages parks, gave a report that those courts are going to stripe for pickleball. This person could not have been happier with the PUD and said, next time you get a chance to talk with Mr. Baker, tell him thank you from the bottom of my heart. It is so hard to find pickleball courts, and we are delighted, and the word will go out. So thank you very much.
Oh, that's great feedback, Commissioner. Yes, just, you know, a reminder for everybody, Walla Walla is going to be coming in within the next couple of weeks here as far as pickleball lines, and then certainly DeRoga, and then hopefully roll out to Lincoln Rock next year. So, yeah, with your guys' last comments of the parks update, I was sent a couple of local contact informations, folks that play pickleball and tennis, and so I did quite a bit of follow-up just to try to get an understanding of, you know, where the lines should go, how should we paint them, how should we go about modifying the courts, and so I appreciate that feedback. That's always great to hear folks making those comments and hopefully getting out and using our courts. You know, that's what they're there for, so thanks for the feedback.
Yeah, it almost made me seem intelligent as a commissioner. So thank you.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
And just so that folks know, Commissioner Arsenault, who has been a proponent for the pickleball courts, has also challenged us to think about whether we might do something, because apparently the net height is not exactly the same between a tennis court and a pickleball court. And as I understand it, that there's a particular drop shot that Commissioner Arsenault likes to perform that is not possible with the tennis net being where it is. And so, Ryan, this is something else that we need to talk about, is following up on what would be a bigger change, honestly, and more difficult to put in than just restriping, but thinking about whether we move to the right size net for a pickleball court. So.
You know, Steve, though, I'm not sure we should be accommodating a dirty player.
I suppose at some point the president should regain control of the meeting.
Randy, this is Steve. I have a question for Ryan.
Yes.
Ryan, do you think it was fortuitous for us to, even though you had some challenges, I am just amazed. In fact, I am sitting in my Airstream right now, coming down to southern Idaho, 1st of April, not being able to find reservations a week or two in places that typically I never had any problems. And I think COVID has changed. This is one of the things that's changed in our COVID's had an impact on our world around us. If you go to the Airstream dealer here in any of the places or other RV places, they're sold out. They have to leave units in their showrooms so they have something to show, but there's 4 and 6 month waits. And it just seems to me that the timing of this couldn't have been better, that we've got to be operating very nimbly with our reservation system in order to meet people's needs and keep people happy. So, and I appreciated Gary's thoughts for our own customers, because it is just challenging for people to get out and vacation now. And so anyway, just a few thoughts for somebody who's actually sitting in their trailer right now.
Yes, you have a great point, Commissioner. And yeah, I think the timing was perfect. We started on this project a few years ago, kind of seeing this coming and watching the trends go up. But in talking to some of our other operating partners and folks that kind of went through the last COVID year, you know, our best guess is we saw anywhere from a, you know, a 30 to 45% increase in some of the local campgrounds and in the Northwest. So I think you're right. Lots of folks are wanting to get out, and having a system in place and you know, something that works very well, and folks have that guarantee and they know when they pull up, is absolutely a good thing. And so I think the timing couldn't have been better.
Yeah, and just not having people sitting waiting in line, and that's seems to be huge to me. So good job. Thank you very much for your work on that.
Oh, you bet. Thank you for the commission support with the reservation system. We're, although we're going through some challenges right now, I think at, you know, the end of the game, it will be a benefit to everyone that uses the campground.
Thank you, Ryan.
You bet. Thank you, commissioners.
Steve, additional manager items.
Just got one more. Did want to bring it to the commission's attention. We've of course, started with independent operations a year ago. This particular March seemed to be more difficult than some we've had in the past, and we'll be doing a report for the board at a future board meeting. But saw some data this morning that I thought was worth bringing to your attention, because there may be some folks out there that are boating that may notice that the reservoir seems low. For the month of March, the flows on the system were in the 1 in 20-year type level in terms of them being low. So we just haven't had as much water. There are some issues associated with independent operations that have been a challenge for us as well. But the fundamental issue has just been the amount of water coming downstream. So yes, in fact, if you've got a customer that are speaking to you about the, it seems like the river and the reservoir are lower than usual, the answer for March is yes, it has been. And we'll be getting you some more data to display that at a future board meeting.
Okay. Thank you.
And that's it.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. Randy, I have
yes,
a question.
Ann. Yes.
Yeah, so lower water flows, isn't that directly tied to the late snow fall in the mountains, and we haven't had hot weather? And I visited the gorge the other day, and there's very little water coming down the gorge. Aren't we late mm-hmm. this year? Isn't that primarily what's going on?
I think there are a couple of things. Remember, I should have said, we're talking about the Columbia here, which it's not the same as what's going on in Lake Chelan. But for the Columbia, the month of March, there was just very little snowfall in the upper basin. So they were planning for a certain level of stream flow coming out, and then got a lot less, which translated into keeping more water in Grand Coulee than they had been planning to. They would have normally brought Grand Coulee down further in the month of March, but now with an expectation of lower overall stream flow, they just kept it higher. And so we just got less water out of Grand Coulee this year than we would have normally gotten.
Okay. You say that's it on manager items?
That's it, yep.
Okay, on commissioner items, I thought I might start. I'm not certain how many of my fellow commissioners have read the obituaries in the paper this past week, but we had a former commissioner pass away this past week. Bob Boyd, up from Beshaston, and you know, I was the commissioner that replaced Bob some 14 years ago. And we all know what it takes to be a commissioner, and the sacrifice that we make in the being part of public life. And I just thought I wanted to recognize the fact that Bob did serve for 12 years and was a very dedicated commissioner in his time. And if anybody wanted to add anything further, I think Ann might want to say something. She did serve with Bob. None of the rest of us did.
Thanks, Randy. I do. I served with Bob, and Bob was a really hardworking commissioner, and he loved the PUD. He loved the district. Bob made a mistake, and I think most people are aware of what happened, and he was remorseful. And, you know, we all make mistakes. We're all flawed, at least I am, and, he deserves recognition for hard work and dedication to the district. So thanks for that, Randy.
You bet. Are there other commissioner items?
I have something that I can go last. I don't want to dominate the conversation.
Well, I didn't hear any other commissioners stepping up, so Ann, it's your turn again.
Okie dokie, thank you. So I am very excited. I went to the website this morning, deschelandpud.org, and we have featured Meet the Women Who Made Chelan PUD mm-hmm. History. And I'm really delighted because I called Rachel last month and I said, hey, Rachel, it's Women's History Month, and I've seen a few, you know, things on other, you know, that's on my brain. did a feature, and I said, are we doing anything for women? And she said, well, I don't think we are. And so we talked for a minute, and then she took the ball and ran with it, and she's done a really nice, she or team have done a really nice job of featuring women in the PUD who've made history. And I think that what I'm seeing here, if you want to go to it, if you haven't seen it, just go to the website and it pops right up on the top. You'll see Kelly Boyd, you'll see Jean Ludwig, and you will see, operator Patricia Duffy. There are a few other featured, and of course we've had lots of women over the years work for the PUD. And so I think what Rachel's plan is to not stop now because Women's History Month is over, but to continue to feature women in public power over the next several months. Maybe she might want to tell you more about it, but I just want to read a couple things if I may take the time. Patricia Duffy, she credits PUD apprenticeship and continuing education for her ascent from janitorial work to power plant chief operator. So she did very well, and she credits all the people around her who helped her and tutored her. And her advice to young women considering the energy sector is always seek opportunities to learn. There's always more to learn, and you can you can do it. And then I want to go back to Jean Ludwig. Mm-hmm. Jean was the first woman PUD commissioner in the state, and she started serving in 1978 and served until 1990. She was actually my mother's best friend, and she Jean was the one who encouraged me to run for PUD commissioner, and she gave me some very, very good advice. But she was a wonderful woman, and she passed away in what's been several years now, 2013. But anyway, I just wanted to say to Rachel, thank you so much. You've done a wonderful job. I think this is very important. There are not very many women to this day in governance, but we're seeing lots more women operators and women CEOs in public power, and I couldn't be happier. Thank you so much.
May I comment?
You bet.
Ann, thank you for that. And I think one of the great women in public power was Vera Claussen from Grant County, who did some things that in terms of our relationship with our Native American partners and others that have had a lifetime lasting influence. And so thank you, for bringing that forward, and the contributions have been tremendous and much appreciated.
May I also make a comment?
You bet.
And thank you for pointing this out. I think it was a wonderful thing that has been done. Although there was one name not mentioned that I noticed on my computer when I came in, and that was Carol Wardell. And she has left a lasting mark on the PUD. Certainly had an instrumental hand in the Alcoa contract, and which has been so profitable for the PUD. So I just wanted to make sure that I was able to get her name on record as well. So
she's there. Gary, she is there.
Yes, good.
You just have to scroll. You just scroll to the right, and she's featured with comments.
Thank you,
yeah.
Ann.
Yeah, she should be there for sure. I agree with you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very important. Yep.
Thank you for that, Ann. That was great. Any other commissioner items? Hearing none, we'll talk about commissioner travel, and I went to Wenatchee this week. Anybody else going anywhere? Is Lisa there?
She's on her way in.
She is.
Okay, she's
there
now.
Sorry about that. Hello, commissioners.
Hi.
Hi, Lisa.
Surprise, we don't have any new travel information. Unless
the word is, Lisa, that the PUD Association is looking for a venue for July.
Okay.
It can be potentially in person, but there's nothing firm yet. Unless Gary has updated information.
No, I don't have any updated information beyond that.
Okay.
So I think that does it for travel.
I have a question. Do we have any commissioners traveling to the APPA conference in Florida?
Not here.
No.
Not that I know of.
No. Thank you.
So it's possible that I may be traveling. Not a commissioner, but just as an APPA board member.
Okay.
Good. Thank you.
Okay, Steve, do we have a follow-up on delegation of action items from previous meetings?
We had one with respect to Commissioner Arsenault had wanted some additional information on the value of hydro, environmental, and capacity attributes. We've had a conversation about that got us at least partway there, and he'll let me know if there's more that he wants. So if that one's good, we'll call that one good for now.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. We also had a follow-up to get you information about the Wi-Fi pilot program at BB Bridge, and Justin sent out an email on March 16th about that. We'd also like to take a couple of things out of the parking lot. We had one with respect to information on the cost of connection fees for purchasers of low-income housing. You saw that presentation today. And one that was a request to address resource adequacy, and you heard from Rob Davis today about that. And that's it.
All right. Anything from today?
Have a couple things. Got a request to have Ryan take a look at the information or the question of whether Chelan County residents should be provided early access to the park reservation system. And then I committed that I will get you some more information in the future about the low flows in March and what the contributing factors to that.
Okay. That's it then?
That's it.
Is there any additional public comment? Any matters that need of general business that need to come before the commission? So we have need for an executive session of approximately 90 minutes.
Yes, please.
So I would, if there's no objection, after a 5-minute break, We will come back into executive session. We have a different Teams number, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct.
And to discuss litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or is likely to become a party, and or legal risks as authorized by the RCWs. So let's take a short break and come back into executive session. This is Randy Smith with Chelan PUD, April 5, 2021. We are coming out of executive session. No votes were taken. No decisions were made. Is there any further business to come before the board? Hearing none, the meeting will stand adjourned.